Hello and welcome to Conservation Connections. This is the monthly podcast of Valley Stewardship Network, and I'm Beth Summers, the Executive Director of Valley Stewardship Network here in Viroqua, Wisconsin, and excited to have Terry Allendorf here in the studio today, actually calling into the studio. She is the Director of Community Conservation, and that is a worldwide conservation nonprofit. Technically based out of Viroqua, Wisconsin, but Terry, you're in Madison today, aren't you?
I live in Mazomene.
Yeah, well, thanks for calling in. Great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah.
So I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about your organization. I myself only kind of know the basics, so I'm excited to find out more details about the background and all the different projects that you've done. And your organization was founded in 1989, right, by Rob Horwich, and works all over the world, correct?
Yep, that is correct, yep. Rob, right out of Gay's Mills there, near Viroqua.
And I was looking on your website a little bit, and it says the mission of community conservation is to promote global biodiversity and sustainable land use by catalyzing, facilitating, and empowering local people to manage and conserve natural resources within the social, cultural, and economic context of their communities, and facilitating widespread global adoption of community-based conservation. What does that all mean? What kind of, in practice?
Kind of a long mission statement, isn't
it?
And I think in short, we like to say we want to put communities at the heart of conservation around the world, right? Not just here in Wisconsin where Rob was working in the 80s and 90s, you know, in the 2000s, but you know, all around the world, everywhere. So community conservation has been around since 1989 when Rob started it, and we've had over 30 projects in about 18 countries. And the second part of that mission statement is getting at trying to really make community conservation one of the first places that conservationists go to conserve biodiversity, right? Rather than sometimes kind of more the last. And so that's kind of the short and of what community conservation is trying to achieve.
And how did you get involved with community conservation? Have you been with the organization a long time?
Yeah, I think I first met Rob through a Smithsonian friend in about 2010 or 11. Actually, must have been more like 2009 because we worked on a paper together. So I came on as like more of a technical colleague to help with the paper for the project in Assam, India, that Rob was working on at the time. And then joined the board in 2011 because we realized that our interests in communities totally dovetailed and interconnected, and we had very similar ideas about communities and experiences around the world. So I came onto the board and was on the board until I became the executive director about 5 years ago now. Rob passed away in 2017, and we've sort of were transitioning, and it just became clear that the dovetail was so great that it made sense just to take on the directorship and move away from the board.
So you took up the reins after Rob's death. What spurred Rob to originally start the organization? Do you know how that originally began?
Yep. He, in about 1984, went down to Belize, and he was a primatologist, and he was very interested in finding endangered primates in different places that he'd worked. And so he was in Belize, and he asked someone about howler monkeys, and they said, if you head to go to the end of the road here at this place, and then there is going to be like a little river, and across the river you can take a little boat across, there'll be a big tree, and in that big tree you'll see black howler monkeys, locally called baboons. And so he went there and he found those black howler monkeys, and then he just started walking around and talking to people in the community about how they could protect this endangered species that they had in such relatively great abundance right there in those villages there, in those small communities. And that was the birth of the first community conservation project that Rob really got going. And one of the only, I think about the only one we've had on private land, because those were farmers with their own private land that Rob then worked with local community members to protect the riparian habitat, the trees and vegetation along the rivers, around these agricultural lands that the farmers had. So that was how it got started. Rob did that. And, you know, I think he wasn't alone in the world at that time, right? We started in the 80s and 90s really starting to think more about communities but he definitely took it to, I think, a new level and a new commitment of really trying to put agency and technical capacity into communities' hands, right? Letting them express their own values towards biodiversity and conserve it, not just be conceived of as recipients of benefits from biodiversity conservation.
Yeah, so that model that Rob developed there in Belize, was that the starting point of the 9-step model of community conservation that it mentions on your website?
Yeah, probably his thinking of the 9 steps came much later, because his 9 steps is really based so much on all the experience he had in so many countries working with communities. And I like to think it's kind of a nice heuristic 9 steps. Just based on when you went into communities, what actually happened, right? Based on trial and error, what are the steps that he actually saw worked in terms of forming relationships with communities? Yeah, so that's how I would describe that 9-step, and probably didn't come along till many years later, articulated so well.
And so what do those 9 steps involve that he eventually worked out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in general, it means the first step, you know, is actually identifying communities, species, project sites, right? Going to those communities, meeting with people, sharing information about, you know, as our perspective as conservationists or scientists, what's the biodiversity that's interesting, and finding out from their perspective what's interesting or what things are they facing in terms of their environment. Most places we work, we're going because species are endangered, and communities are also seeing that, right? They're seeing the habitats that they rely on, or the trees or the water that they rely on, being degraded. So they also want to protect what's there, but they often don't have the outside support or the technical capacity or knowledge to really put that into action in a lot of places. So the first step is sort of just getting to know each other, sharing information, finding common ground, some common values, a common vision, doing some workshops and trainings once those have been identified and you figure out what it is people are interested in. And then from that process, usually local conservation leaders start arising. So you might initially have, you know, like the village people, the village leaders interested, or the community leaders interested, but then you need to find the people who are actually really wanting to do the work itself for conservation. And those people usually emerge, and then they're the ones who kind of gather broader support and sort of help those conservation processes go. And then you've got to figure out actual plans that you want to do, right? And Rob sort of worked a lot on thinking about education centers, or, you know, management plans for certain species. And there's different kinds of, you know, he called it infrastructure you can put into place for conservation. But just figuring out, you know, something, what do we actually want to protect? How do we protect it? How do you monitor and enforce protection of that habitat or that species? That's kind of the core of the next step of putting things onto paper and figuring out a plan. And then ultimately, you know, hopefully you step away. Either there already are organizations in the community, or you've helped to create them that have the governance and management capacity to continue conservation on whatever species and habitat you're working on. And then there's a couple other final steps in the process that kind of keep going. And one is thinking about horizontal contagion, Rob called it, conservation contagion, where if one village is having a project, often many other villages also want to begin doing it because they're seeing the results. And so that happened in Belize with that very first project. Even to this day, when I talk to the person who's in charge of the board now, she says if they had unlimited resources, they have all these communities that want to do what they're doing, and they just can't help support them all. So the need is, you know, every community would like help. There's so many that want to do this kind of process. And then the other piece is sort of a vertical contagion, is you want government, you want government agencies and other NGOs and other people sort of, you know, not at the community level, but at higher kind of scales, supporting it and getting excited about it. And he saw that in a lot of the projects he worked on, that contagion going both vertically and horizontally. So that's, in a nutshell, kind of the process of how it works. And Rob and I will both say what is really key to this is we have actually never walked into, you would say, and I still feel this way, walked into a community where there wasn't someone who was interested in talking to us about biodiversity, right, who wanted to have a conversation. There's always an interest in it when you walk into communities. And I think that's a really important thing to understand, that kind of explains why this process can work, right, because there's always that interest.
Mm. So it sounds like this work is a lot about empowering community members to achieve conservation goals that they already have, rather than coming in with an outside agenda, right?
Yeah, yeah. And goals they may not have fully articulated or realized, right, but that they're seeing problems or threats, or they're seeing species or ecosystem functions that are getting threatened. So, yeah, they have a vested interest in learning more and doing more, yes.
Are there times where these conservation goals need to be balanced with other potentially conflicting community priorities, like how they're making a living, land rights, food security, those kinds of issues?
Yeah, those are all obviously really important to the context and how it happens, and issues usually that are part of the process of the community figuring out how to manage and govern the resources, right? And that's part of like the local conservation leaders then being the ones who help drive a lot of the conversation and the process rather than us as outsiders, right? We're supporting them to have that conversation. In some contexts, it's pretty easy because like in a place like Nepal, there's already community forestry. So there's already in Nepal, don't want to leap ahead too much here, but we're trying to integrate wildlife into an existing structure of community forestry. And then in other countries, there aren't those existing systems and organizations. And we're sort of having to start from scratch with communities, helping them figure out how to organize and how they can, you know, what the goals are when they see environmental threats.
Well, I'd love to hear some more of those examples, like the one you just brought up in Nepal, the types of projects that you have going on.
Yeah, so that's one where the community in Nepal, in the last, they've had community forestry for 50 years. You know, it's a national policy. Half of the households in Nepal are involved in it, and they've actually doubled their forest cover since the 1980s, early 1990s when community forestry started. So in terms of habitats, it's pretty amazing what they've achieved with that. And they have some of the, in the national parks, they have some of the best examples of sustainable populations of tigers and rhinos. They've still got elephants roaming the landscape. So it's a pretty amazing conservation story, and I would say the premier world-wide example of community conservation. It was not just me. The research has also shown, like, in terms of a national-level community conservation approach, Nepal is really a global example. But they don't have much wildlife management integrated into community forestry for various reasons. So we're working, one of Rob's last ideas before he died was to create a corridor from one of our most successful projects in Assam in India for the Golden Langur over to Chitwan National Park in Nepal. And so we're still working on sort of a wildlife corridor in Nepal along the community forest that would link with India. And so trying to help communities know how to do camera trapping, how to monitor wildlife, how to find out, you know, what's in their forest, if it's increasing or decreasing, and then how to sort of co-manage with other community forests since the landscape, you know, one community forest doesn't protect an entire population. So that's one thing where we're sort of integrating more conservation into the conservation that's already happening. But then we have other countries like Malaysia, where we have a project that we're collaborating with the Smithsonian on, where they it was a research project in a national park, which sort of used local communities as people who could help guide the research team. And the main woman in charge of that project really wanted to turn that into more of a community-based project that helped the community conserve and mitigate the threats that they were facing from illegal, you know, logging companies coming in and poachers. And so she really wanted to begin to work with them. But what we find there is, although Malaysia has a lot of policies around indigenous peoples and tenure, you know, and traditional tenure rights, there's really not much, there's no way for the community, there's no existing organizational support in terms of how do they manage those traditional areas. And so we're really starting from scratch with them on figuring out what are their priorities, how can they organize, what resources do they have in their own communities. And those are kind of so two extreme examples of going into a particular community and the resources that are available to them and the way they're already organized to do conservation. And so in Nepal, where they're extremely well organized in some ways, and then a place like Malaysia, where there's in terms of the community, there's not much yet going on. And then we have a ton of examples in between along the whole spectrum.
So when you're choosing a species to focus on, are you selecting a species that's charismatic with the hopes that they'll encompass the needs of a lot of different aspects of that ecosystem? Or is it more about the individual species and the fact that they're imperiled?
Yeah, so it kind of depends, because a lot of the projects that Rob began over those years, he was going and picking up on particular species, right, or was being invited in, like in Assam, he was invited in to help consult on the Golden Langur. And so because of his own interest in primatology and primates and expertise, a lot of them did begin with primates. But then, like, this corridor project is more of an umbrella project where there's not necessarily a specific species that we're picking up on. We worked on the pangolin in the corridor because it exists along the whole stretch of it, and also elephants are in the corridor, so that could be another species that one picks up on. But when we go to the communities themselves, there's often not one. Like when we were focusing on pangolin, we had some community members say to us, hey, why are you focusing on pangolin? There's so many wildlife species in these areas. And so it really depends on the, I mean, historically, yes, we try to focus on a species, and in terms of monitoring, that's really important. So both the Assam and the Belize Project have those key species that are being monitored. But in terms of our overall goal of supporting communities, we really try to figure out what the communities are interested in monitoring and conserving, and how they want to do it. And they really see how it's all integrated. At the community level, they sort of know that all those pieces are necessary in the ecosystem.
And is there a certain point at which community conservation's work there is done, and you consider it in the hands of the community and time to back away? How do you know when you're finished, or are you ever finished with a project?
Yeah, I would say if we look historically just at our project, so like Assam and Belize, there's many, many projects we've walked away, and the oldest and most successful are the Assam and Belize projects. And what we saw in both of those cases is they continued to function. So Belize, Rob kept going and was working with them, but basically they're sustainable and they do it all on their own. And then the same in Assam. It's a totally sustainable conservation project in terms of local communities and local support for them. But it's never ending, right? So we can say it's successful and sustainable, but tracking what those groups have had to go through over the years, because they continue to fight the same battles, trying to get funding. In Belize, they haven't been able to do a full census of the monkeys since, I think, 2012, because they just can't get enough. You know, they can get funding for some things, right? But they have not been able to put together enough for a census of the monkeys. And then in Assam, they did such a great job with the golden langur in one of the areas that the government wanted to turn it into a national park. So they've had to fight the government in terms of trying to maintain their control over the area as a community conservation area. So what you see is we step away as an organization because, you know, community has the capacity and they've registered their you know, the land in some way, shape, or form to officially manage and protect it. But they continue to struggle and have to keep fighting the same battle. So, you know, nothing is ever over when it comes to conservation and protecting habitat, it feels like.
Yeah, and it sounds like those two examples, Belize and Assam, are great success stories. Do you have any other projects that you consider especially successful?
Yeah, and maybe this is also maybe more of a contrasting example, too, that I haven't talked about yet, and those are our projects in Peru with our partner, the Neotropical Primate Conservation. So most countries, we work through partners who are on the ground, local smaller organizations working with the communities directly, right, who are there day-to-day working with them. And in Peru, it's interesting because in Peru, there's what they have for the policy is conservation concessions, which actually anyone can, like, register and get. It's a very confusing policy to me, but basically the partner can, and then other partners too, other NGOs in the area, use the conservation concession as a way for communities to get control over areas to protect them for conservation, right? So it could be, I think private individuals could do it, you know, smaller groups of people, but our partner, you know, works with communities to create conservation concessions. So in that case, it's a pretty nice model because the policy exists to create these concessions. The NGO supports the community to write the reports, to get it registered and formally recognized, and then boom, you've got a new protected area. So that's a case where you can have, you know, basically a new protected area that communities are managing every time you get one registered. So they've registered about, you know, 11 in the past 10 or 20 years. And again, for them, sort of like in Belize, there's no end to the communities that would like to register concessions. It's just a matter of trying to meet everyone's need.
It must be challenging for you as an English speaker, an American, to be working in so many different places around the world. How do you get past that communication barrier?
Yeah, it's not easy. It's not easy, and that is why the local partners, right, can be so helpful. You know, so obviously I can't go into context that I don't know, and neither could Rob, right? We have to find the partners and the people on the ground. And sometimes, like the Peru partner is one that Rob sort of, he met them at a professional meeting, got interested in their work, and they're doing, you know, lots of work with primates too. And so they found out that they sort of had the same approach, And yet Rob was able to bring them a lot of lessons that they hadn't quite gotten to yet, because they were kind of a younger organization and younger scientists. So he was really able to share his broader experiences with them. So, sorry.
Yeah. What other challenges do you encounter? What are the hardest things about this work?
Having those local partners who really know the context is really important. It is amazing around the world now how much English is increasing. So even in my own experiences in the last 10 or 20 years, English as a universal language is pretty amazing. So that has also been helping.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, what other things have you found difficult, challenges that you've overcome in these projects?
Challenges we've overcome. They're always, working with partners in such a distant way, so there's very practical things that can happen. But I think sometimes people might think that culturally things can be difficult, but one thing we found with the model is that it really works across cultures. And so it's a pretty uniform way to work with people. And actually, it's funny, our Cameroonian partner, who has an NGO, so it's Dennis Ndelo, who has an NGO called Community-Based Biosynergy Management, and he also was a young scientist who started working with Rob on the Cross River Gorilla in Cameroon, and then he started his own NGO. And he would say that when Rob came to Cameroon and worked with him, he kept telling Rob, well, Rob, that won't work here because this is Cameroon and there's a cultural context you're not understanding. And Rob would say, no, this is the way to do it, right? We need to include everyone in the community, or we need to have a meeting like this, right? And Dennis would say Rob had this really rigid recipe, which you think would be bad because we get worried about cultural context. But the recipe itself is rigid, but it really adapts well to different cultural contexts. And basically, the recipe is the community. Everyone in the community should have a chance to be involved and have a say and learn what's going on, right? That's one of the basic tenets of community conservation, and that translates into any culture anywhere. And of course, some of the challenges are cultural barriers, like can women be invited to meetings or not, right? Because a lot of cultural contexts, maybe only the men get invited to learn about a project or to participate in something. And sort of one thing I learned in Nepal, working in Nepal, because they've been really good about setting policies that require women to participate. And it's really had a huge impact on how well they've been able to do conservation in Nepal. So for me personally, when I go to a country, we really need to invite women. And this happened in Myanmar, because I worked in Myanmar since 1999. And a similar issue happened where they're like, no, Terry, we can't invite women to these meetings. It's just not done. And I'm like, no, we have to. This is why we have to. And in Nepal, it works. If you do it, it works, right? We can't make them come, right? But we can at least say how important it is and try and explain why it's important and make sure they get the invitation. So there are some cultural barriers, but when it comes to conservation, you want to just try and be as inclusive as you can and be giving people opportunities to participate in conservation, which is as true, in Viroqua or Meghamani as it is in, whatever villages we are in different countries around the world.
How interesting how the same principles apply across so many different cultures. Yeah.
Yeah.
And have you ever had a difficult time as an outsider getting buy-in or trust from local communities?
Yeah, and maybe not so much me as an outsider, but, even seeing like our partners, right? Because even if you come from the capital or you come from the next place over, right, it doesn't really matter. People have to get to know you and trust you. And in Nepal, which has had such a long history of development and so many projects, development projects, conservation projects, health projects, every community has some experience with development money. Building that trust can be really hard. And we have the problem in a place like Nepal, and this happens in other places too, where people, sometimes there are certain groups that just want to know, well, how much money are you bringing, right? What are you going to give us, right? Because that's how development and conservation has been done so many times by big organizations. And, our partner in Nepal really struggles with building that trust with them from scratch in terms of, no, we don't have lots of large funding. We are here to support you and meet the needs that you identify as having and meet your goals for conservation. And we want to work on that together with you, right? We're not here to give you a lot of money in order to conserve the pangolin. We're not going to say, here's the money, now do it, right? We want to work with you to co-create conservation. And so that can be a real struggle in some communities. And having the right people then, that's where sometimes it takes a while for the right leaders to emerge, right? Because looking at people, if you come with a project, they might emerge for the wrong reasons initially. And you've got to try and, you know, be patient and take your time and build the right relationships so then the right people are involved in the project.
Sure. Well, for listeners who are interested in this work and want to know how to find out more information or how they might contribute or support your work, where would you direct them?
Yeah, I would say you can go to our website, communityconservation.org. You'll see examples of our projects. We have some other information about ways you can be involved. And then, you know, just become involved in conservation yourself if you're not already. If you're interested, you know, you can support organizations like ours, or you can just get out there in your own communities and find out what opportunities are. I think that's just really important for people to just sort of realize that, you know, as you look for opportunities to conserve biodiversity in your own area, so are people all around the world in the communities where we're working. We have so much in common with them.
Well, fantastic. And we're actually looking forward to having you come and speak with us about some efforts in our own local community to conserve bird habitat within our Kickapoo Wildcat Mountain important bird area. So that'll be happening on May 16th, which is a Saturday, out at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve Visitor Center. So we're really fortunate to have your help with our own community initiative. Really looking forward to that, Terry.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to that, too, and sharing these stories and looking at the commonalities. I have worked internationally most of my career, but the more I sort of dig into the different ways that Rob and community conservation have participated, you know, in Wisconsin, the parallels are just glaring sometimes, and I'm really looking forward to working with you guys on thinking about those more.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, thanks so much, Terry. It was really great to talk with you today.
Thank you.